We are here today on Disability Bandwidth. And to start, Sam, I would love it if you could introduce yourself.
Sure, make me go first. No, I'm kidding. I'm Sam Pru. I'm the accessibility evangelist at Fable, which means that I talk a lot about accessibility, how to do it, why it matters, all of that good stuff. And I also talk a lot about why it's so important to involve the voices and the lived experience of actual people with disability in all of your kind of product and development processes, right? From research and prototype through to, you know, through to coding and design and ideation and testing and all of that. Because, you know, as the saying goes, nothing about us without us. And that's, you know, what Fable helps companies do is get that voice of folks with lived experience of assistive technology involved in research and testing. A little bit about me. I am completely blind. I've been using screen readers all of my life. And my father was also completely blind. So there has been a talking computer in the house for as long as I can remember. My father worked for IBM for over 30 years. So I've always sort of had the incredible privilege of being at the very forefront of technology and watching as the industry has grown and changed in really exciting ways. Visual description of me always feels weird because as someone who is completely blind, I do not look in a mirror. And so what you get in a visual description is more how I perceive myself than mm-hmm. what the actual reality of the thing is. But I'm a white dude with the facial hair and a Ravenclaw crest off to my left and a Brailler behind me. And I tend to wear boring clothing, I think is probably the best way to put it. Do you disagree?
No, it's not necessarily boring clothing. You wear a lot of collared shirts. I mostly can only see from the hip up, you know. I mean, like, I only see your shoulders, so
I mean, reveal right at the end here, there's nothing, you know, shoulders down. I'm just a floating head. No.
That would be such an epic reveal. Oh my gosh.
I always tease people at work when I meet them for the first time. Wow, so you're not just an AI? That's cool. All right. yeah. Hey, we got to meet at some point. I think we're making that clear. And then why don't I turn it over to you? Enough of my silliness.
I am Nikki Nolan. Did you say your pronouns? I don't know. You did, didn't you? Okay.
Well, I might have just said man, but he, him. Yes.
So my pronouns are she, they, and I actually just shifted to she, they, mostly because if my gender doesn't matter in the context of why someone's talking about me, I prefer them just to say they or them or something like that. Like, I don't really think that my gender matters when describing things that I do. So that's why I use she, they. My title, I am a podcast host. I am an artist. I am a software product designer for the moment. And I've been getting more involved with what is disability and what is my lived experience and really owning my lived experience as something that is like important and that I would love to share more about because I think I have I don't think I have a unique story, but I have an interesting story where I have been misdiagnosed several times and I have an invisible disability and my invisible disability is sometimes visible when I'm writing. I'm dyslexic. I have sensory processing disorder. I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. I have mobility issues on my right side from a vehicle accident that happened a few years ago. I had reconstructive foot surgery, so I have a little bit of like limited range in my feet. Yeah, it's just a ball of fun inside my body. Mm. And also, I believe I'm on the spectrum, which, you know, I don't know. There's no diagnosis, but there's a lot of indicators that I see that I have a lot of traits about that.
Visual description. Of, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, let's go visual. Let's go visual. So I am a white woman who is 5'6". I have dark brown hair with bangs. My hair goes past my shoulders. I typically am wearing a jumpsuit with a very loud pattern on it. Usually it has like tigers or rainbows or smiley faces on it and triangles. So if you come across me, I'm typically wearing that. I have blue eyes and I am left-handed. I mean, that's not a visual description, but I am left-handed. I was doing a body scan and I was like, what are things about my... And in my background, I have bike and some artwork because I collect artwork. That's one of my like hobbies is I love art. I have a master's degree in fine art. also a bachelor's degree in fine art, and transitioned into tech to pay off my student loans, which I actually did, and have another podcast about it that people can check out if they want, called Matter of Life and Debt.
Hey, what a fun transition from art to like design, to like UX design, to software design. I mean, does it feel like you're bringing your art skills to bear, or does it just feel like you're following the rules of the design system and doing the thing in a kind of robotic way?
Oh, that's a great question. So like for me, the transition was not planned. Like I didn't plan to go into design. However, I don't dislike that I'm in design. I think design has the opportunity to solve a lot of problems. And so I do love that aspect of design. I do feel like they are two different worlds for me, though. I thought I was going to be an artist, and then saddled myself with a little bit too much debt, which made it impossible for me to pursue that then. And just found myself sort of haphazardly, you know, landing these positions where the theme kept coming up, do design. And I initially had started out as a front-end engineer, quickly learned that I did not enjoy doing that. And so the company I was working for was like, yeah, you don't seem like you like this. And they actually were like, now you're the designer. And then I had to like quickly ramp up and figure out what that meant. And so I am not a trained designer, but I am a on-the-job trained designer. It's really fun to solve visual problems for me, but it's also really fun for me to solve real problems. And I think that's where I struggle a little bit with design, is because sometimes I will see design only solving visual problems when I like to solve fundamental problems. I like to uncover what is going on and see how I can remove barriers to allowing people to achieve whatever they're trying to achieve. And so I do think through design, you can do those things.
I mean, that's the line into sort of front-end engineer, into design work, right? Because it feels like with a master's in fine arts, there's a whole other path around like pop art that you could have, you know, kind of done the soup cans, as the famous saying goes, right? Like,
I am not a pop artist. I am a conceptual installation artist, and it's not everybody's cup of tea. So I am not very sellable. I'm not very commodifiable. I don't typically work in the realm of things that people like. If I'm being honest, my art is very like performance art. I'm really into absurdity. I love absurdity, and I love some of my artwork. Most of my artwork is sort of about like the fallibility of human memory and like what we do with the documentation of things and how much more we rely on documentation, videos, audio, all of these things to construct our realities. And so I'm just like really, I play a lot inside of photography. I play a lot inside of sculpture. I play inside of like found artifacts from my childhood. Yeah. So I feel like it's almost compartmentalized for me. It's like, I do my podcasting, I do my art, I have my job, and I'm a designer. And for me, they're all sort of things I pursue with different types of energy and exploration. Mm. Yeah.
Interesting, because I feel like those things, like the fragility of memory and the kind of art installation and the absurdity and stuff, are so deeply connected now, as we have this sort of reality of Facebook and doctored photographs and fake news. And, you know, it brings me to an idea that I've had for a long time that I've always wanted to do just for the heck of it, which is like get access to someone's calendar and give them four things and said, you did three of these four things last week. Which one did you not do? And I bet you most people could not do it, right? Because as soon as you see the thing, it's like, yeah, I probably did that. That sounds like something that'd be on my calendar. I probably did that. And then you remember having done it. Anyway, that's like an aside, but like it's that's always interested me, right? Or the thing, like if you show someone them Photoshopped into a photograph of Disneyland, they now remember going there, even though they didn't.
So I'm really fascinated by a lot of the research that came behind a lot of that stuff. When I was in grad school back in 2009-ish, a lot of my thesis work was around sort of like that scientific information about implanting fake memories of witnesses misremembering things. And all of that stuff led me down this path of really exploring like what photography, social media, social constructs sort of do to us. I actually, there's a YouTube video that you all can go and find of me talking about some of my artwork from back in the day. It's got like baby me talking about. I'll send it to you, Sam. I just realized you don't know. Like, this is like, we've known each other, but you and I haven't actually sat down and talked about this.
I mean, we work together in a very particular vein, and it's like a fun vein. You know what I mean? It's also such a deep and rich vein as we talk to each other and share each other's experiences that I think sometimes we don't move out of that thing.
I really want to ask you about you, Sam. Tell us little bit about you. What got you into being accessibility evangelist? Take me on that path as well.
There was absolutely no plan. All through high school, I did the thing that some, you know, young men do as they grow up and they want to be their fathers. And I sort of felt that I was going to be a computer programmer and that's what I was going to do. Mm-hmm. And I got into high school and I could not do the math. I just couldn't do it. Some of it is because I don't have a natural aptitude, and some of it is because the accessibility resources were not there, right? There was a lot of graphing. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of kind of, once you start to get into like calculus, if you don't have visual aids that are well adapted, you can no longer do it. You can no longer keep up. And so that was a disappointment to me. I had to figure out, like, I can't get the math to go into a computer science degree in university. It's not going to be possible for me. And so I figured, well, what is my second choice? What do I like doing? I like writing. I like speaking. So that must mean I should be a journalist. So I went to university for journalism. And of course, all of the newspapers immediately closed and went away. And just no work there. So I pivoted. It was around this time that it wasn't even cryptocurrency. It was just Bitcoin was becoming a thing. And my father had recently retired from IBM. And neither of us had any sort of political aspirations. We're like, down with fiat currency and let's take control away from the Fed and whatever. It was just like, people are making money at this. He's got 40 years of experience and I'm, you know, pretty intelligent. We should be able to do this. We can make a business. We can do this. Because there was, you know, he was looking for something to do. No prospects for me. So we did it for let's see, like 2012, 2019. Did the whole thing. Had some land. Was running a mining operation, doing some speculation, and did not become a millionaire. But I will say, sort of kept food on the table and never lost money. So
what?
I think that's pretty good. Yeah.
Wow. I didn't even know that about you.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I learned a lot. Those experiences are experiences that I use as much as kind of my university experiences. And I think part of the reason why I got out of it, well, first of all, it is the most stressful thing that you can do, right? Because it's like one day you're a millionaire and the next day you're broke. And like there's nothing that you can do to sort of control the thing. So it's super stressful. The joke I always share kind of with the founders of the company I work at now is, oh, I love the stability of working at a startup, right? compared to what I was doing before.
Wow, that's a statement, Sam. That is a statement. Because you know how notoriously stable startups are.
Oh, compared to Bitcoin, they are a rock of stability. You know that there is going to be probably a paycheck, you know, whereas with Bitcoin, you know, 1 month you're a multimillionaire and 1 month you're not sure if you're going to be able to pay the hydro bill. It's wild, the stress and the number of people in that community who had severe mental problems and lost their lives and just all kinds of stuff.
Oof. Whoa. I didn't know that. I did not know that. So you went from Bitcoin mining to being an evangelist of accessibility.
I went from Bitcoin mining to a founder of Fable, Alvar. She used to work for Rogers, a big telephone communication company here.
Mm-hmm.
And she worked very closely
in Canada.
Yeah,
because not everybody realizes that you're in Canada, I'm in the US.
should clarify that. Yeah, there we go. But anyway, so she worked very closely with my best friend named Dave. And she said to Dave, hey, do you want to, this accessibility stuff, I think we can do it better. I'm going to make a startup. Do you want to come do the startup with me? And Dave said, well, no, I'm not leaving my steady corporate job. I have got a family and an apartment. But why don't you talk to my friend Sam? He's getting out of Bitcoin. I think he's looking for something. And so we met and I immediately got like the vision behind Fable and became like one of the first employees of the company. And I actually started off as the community manager. So I built the kind of first 100 of our testers, all of whom are people with disabilities who use assistive technology, who work with us testing websites and apps and digital products and services. And so I spent quite some time building that. And as I built that, it became clear to me that like the thing that I'm most passionate about is speaking and sharing my experiences, and like presenting and recording doesn't give me nerves, doesn't make me nervous, nothing like that. Mm-hmm. And it also became clear to me that like the skills of managing and building a community to its first 100 are very different from the skills of scaling it to its first 1,000. Because If I bring up my ego and speak for myself, I think I'm pretty personal. And when your community is your first 50 people and you can afford to be personable with each person and you talk to them and you get to know them and you make friends with them and you can get folks to follow you. But I don't work in the kind of organizational metrics kind of way. And so like managing 1,000 people would not work for me. And so I thought, well, why don't I figure out what can I do with these skills of being personable and getting people seem to be willing to listen to me? How can I continue to promote the vision of Fable and let the community manager be someone who has the skills that are now needed for the next order of magnitude? And so that's how I got into being the accessibility evangelist.
Ooh, yeah. Thank you for taking me along that path.
Quite a journey.
Yeah, I love your journey. I just stepped into a reality television show where I love that journey for you, Sam.
Oh, man. And, you know, it was really interesting because as we built Fable and, you know, we have our community and it's kind of like, our community are contractors and it's this like gig economy type thing. Sort of through university, I did that to support myself. I did like the Amazon Mechanical Turk and the associated content and the like all of that gig economy, crowd work, distributed work type stuff. So I came to Fable with a bit of an idea of like what worked there and what didn't work there and what should this be and what should it not be, which I think was really helpful at the beginning when we're trying to figure out what is the thing and how do we build the thing. But of course, now that it's built, now that it is the thing, right? I just have to move on and to do something else. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've done all kinds of things. Someday, I think there is probably a pretty decent science fiction book inside of me. I mean, that's nothing. Ask every single person you will ever meet, and they all intend to write a book at some point. I'm sure you do.
Yeah, I'm sure I do. But also, being someone that's dyslexic, it makes it hard to feel I can pursue that. However, podcasts are really wonderful for me. It's a medium that feels really natural and really easy for me to experience. So I'm really glad that I came across this medium because it is something that I work well with. I am the editor of this podcast as well. You and I are producing it, and Fable is our sponsor. Thank you so much, Fable, for helping this podcast become real. They really have been incredible to work with. I'm so glad that you work there. I feel it's like this company. Yeah, it is. It seems like a really good company. Every single person that I know that works there seems to love it.
I think it might be good for us to, now that we sort of introduced ourselves and people know who we are and a little bit of the lenses that we bring to things and where we're coming from. Let's talk about why we decided to do this podcast together now and why we decided to do the thing.
So yeah, so I met you because I was running an event called Disabled in Tech, and it's a public event that we'll add the link here. And all of the panelists on the panel of Disabled in Tech, where we were sort of talking about how there is a lack of representation of people with disabilities in tech leadership, all of those people from the panel are on this season. I don't remember who specifically at Fable was like, Sam really wants to do a podcast. He is a really great voice for podcasting. The person that introduced me to you, they were just like, Sam would be an amazing podcast person. And that little nugget was in my head. And the person said that before we did the Disabled in Tech event. And the event went so well, and I got such good feedback from it that I was like, we need to keep this conversation going. And so I approached you and was like, would you want to do a podcast? And yeah. You said yes.
Well, yeah, I was like, yeah, absolutely. Because that panel was so great. And in a very real way, this is sort of grown out of that and a follow-up to that, which goes to show that like whatever you do, events can really make changes, you know, even if it feels like, oh, maybe it's just a small event, right? Mm-hmm. It inspires people and gets people to keep the conversation going. But then, you know, you had brought up the podcast to me, and I'd been thinking about doing a podcast for a while, and I'd been thinking and looking around and trying to figure out, like, what do I have to contribute to the podcasting space? Because for those of you who are not aware, there are a lot of really incredible podcasts that are run by incredible blind screen reader using hosts that talk about kind of the screen reader world and the blindness world and the visual impairment world. And I thought, I don't want to do that. There are people, there's nothing wrong with that, but there are people doing a great job of that already, that if you want mm-hmm. that, it is out there. Go listen to it. It's incredible. I don't need to do more of that. There are people who have that, who are doing a great job. And then when you approached me, I thought, yeah, this is something that is new and that is different and that hasn't been done before. And it felt and still feels like you are the ideal co-host. As I frequently joke, you come up with the actual planned questions and then keep me on track as I veer wildly off topic with every interview.
I love your curiosity. I love that you bring this real conversational curiosity. I feel I'm a very structured sort of person. And if I don't have that structure, I like tend to not know what to talk about. But you are teaching me so much more and really helping me get more conversational. And I'm like so appreciative of that. And it's been really lovely having you as the co-host. And one thing I want to touch on, which is something you just said, is what really drew me to this as well, is that there are a lot of podcasts out there that have, you know, two wheelchair users or two people who are on the autism spectrum or two people who have hearing impairments or are deaf, where we have this thing where we join our communities of disabled people and tend to sometimes become insulated. And so mm-hmm. I loved the fact that you have a visible disability and I have an invisible disability. And between those two places and the fact that we've interviewed people with a very wide range of different disabilities, we get to learn from each other. We get to build those connections between each other and see, you know, where we're the same and where we're different and where we need to learn and grow. And I don't know, it's just like, it's really nice to have the space between us and also the similarities.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the first things that I learned when I came to work at Fable and when I started doing the things that I do. I don't know whether it so much applies to other folks, but because screen readers occupy so much of the web accessibility conversation, sometimes you can fall into a trap of thinking that, okay, as a blind person, I am an accessibility expert and I know all the things and it's mm-hmm. cool and great. And like, I've got this. And very quickly learned, as I thought about, well, blind people need to be more included in everything and research and all this the stuff mm-hmm. that people stand for. I very quickly learned that, like, no, I know almost nothing outside of the somewhat narrow community of blindness and visual impairment. And I went on a big kind of learning around that and around mm-hmm. like, you know, voice control and dictation and the needs of folks who have different physical challenges, but hadn't really gotten the opportunity to sort of dig into, you know, folks who are not neurotypical and the challenges that go with that. So I've learned so much from you and from doing this podcast, from you directly and just sort of from the way that you work and the way that we figured out how to work together, as well as from our guests. So if you are one of those folks who maybe is listening to this and thinking, I already know about screen readers, this is what this is, I've got it, you are going to learn so much, just like I did throughout the journey of this thing.
So we ask these questions of almost all of our guests. What is a problem that you have solved that you're really incredibly proud of?
I mean, solved is a very sort of final term.
Yeah.
I really don't like saying that problems are solved, because mm-hmm. there are solutions that work for now, but solutions always need to change and adapt. I don't think any problem is ever completely solved.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I have been sort of tangentially involved with is kind of around access to ebooks. And we have come so far where people who are blind and visually impaired can buy a book on, say, Kindle the day that it's published and be able to mm-hmm. read it. And of course, there's been some things like the Marrakesh Treaty, but there's also been sort of a lot of writing to makers of ebooks and ebook software mm-hmm. and advocacy and all of these things. And I don't even want to say that I've solved it, because it's the entire community of people with visual impairments who worked on this for 7 years and brought it to a solution. It's, I think, one of the greatest changes in sort of the past 7 to 10 years that affects the lives of those who are blind and visually impaired. And perhaps mm-hmm. on something I'm more directly involved with, I am every day, I am making progress on that problem that accessibility is thought of as like a checklist, and it's thought of as just kind of an abstract thing, and nobody puts names to it and faces to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the voices of people with disabilities are left out of design, research, and development. And everything that we do at Fable is working on that problem. Will the problem ever be mm-hmm. solved? No, I don't think it's work that is ever done, but mm-hmm. I'm incredibly proud that I get to get up every day and work on that problem and make it better. I could work at Fable for 150 years and I would never really say the problem is solved. But my goal and my objective, the thing that I'm proud of, is that every year I can say I made it a little bit better. I helped to make things a small bit better in that very particular area. What about you? Now you've got me curious.
The entire time you were talking, I was listening, but also I was like, oh no, I don't know the answer to this question. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh, are we asking of our guests something that's really difficult?
I mean, the thing that I love is that all of our guests have had very unique and fascinating answers to it.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. So what am I incredibly proud of solving something? I guess starting podcast actually has been just a significant shift for me. It took me about 2 years to start my other podcast. I was taking podcasting classes. I took a bunch of writing classes. I really overthought it, which is like something I do. I tend to circle inside my brain and then never start things. And just starting the other podcast that I did and getting into the workflow. And I actually have brought on a new host for that show so that I could dedicate myself to focusing on this podcast, producing and creating the space for people. I really think that, like, I am so incredibly proud of the thing that I solved was, like, how do I even make a podcast? How do I even get it from point A to point B? And I've been learning along the way, and I won't say that I'm like perfect at this, but it brings me a lot of joy and it brings me a lot of happiness to have this dedicated time to talk to people about interesting topics and then be able to share those interesting conversations out with the world. It's really, it's brought so much into my life. Like, two of my best friends are previous guests on my other podcast. We talk pretty much daily, and it's just given me so much. It really, podcasting has given me so much. And I'm so glad that I figured out how to do it.
Yeah. I mean, podcasting is like radio used to be, right? It's a very intimate experience of sitting down with people. And yet it's that intimate experience that's shared with the whole world. It's sort of where radio used to be when I wanted to get into it, you know, through the 40s and 50s and 60s. It unfortunately, in a lot of ways, is not that anymore because tastes have changed. Realities have changed, and now podcasting does the thing, so that's fine. But I mean, radio was sort of a thing that I thought about getting into. Did kind of some internet radio as a teenager, you know, where you host the whole thing and take all the calls, and got completely burnt out on it because doing it all yourself is very stressful. Live, you know, it's
I mean, up until recently, I was doing everything on my first podcast and then brought in someone that brought in another person. And what I've loved about this podcast is how supportive Fable has been, not only in being our sponsor, but they help us with visuals and they give a lot of feedback that's like really, really moves us forwards. So I'd love to transition into, what do you feel is your biggest frustration in your career? And is it still happening?
How do you decide whether one is bigger or worse than the other? So I'll just sort of list off a few. First of all, is the underemployment of people with disabilities. That is such a large problem, and you really need to solve it holistically. There's been a lot of focus on sort of in the past, like, oh, if we give people with disabilities good enough technology, the employment problem will go away. And it didn't go away. And then we said, oh, if we give people with disabilities enough access to education, which we still haven't really done, but still, like, we improved that and the unemployment problem go away. But because it's about technology access, it's about education, it's about representation, it's about sort of ending discrimination, it's about accessibility. It's such a multifaceted problem. I think we are making progress, but like, it is a problem that needs multiple people and organizations and communities to work at in a coordinated way. And I think it needs to be done in a cross disability kind of way. I don't think we can sit here and I can solve underemployment for blind people and just like, oh, well, I'm not going to work with deaf and hard of hearing people. I'm not going to work with people with cognitive challenges because that's not the problem I'm trying to solve. Right. But I think there's maybe even in other communities, right, folks who are not neurotypical, maybe they say, well, we're going to solve the problem for us. We're not going to work with blind people or with, because that's not the problem. That's not a problem. And it's just very frustrating to me that even to this day, I think there's still a reluctance for various organizations to work together. And there is also in some communities, a belief that accessibility is kind of a limited pie that lets other people set people with disabilities against each other right? There's the like, oh, well, everything gets captioned. There's not going to be enough money to do the audio descriptions, right? If we have to audio describe everything, there's not going to be enough money to do the sign language. And like, oh, well, there's only so much time and effort people are going to put into accessibility. So we have to fight to make sure that our thing is first, even if that means other people's thing doesn't get done. And so we can't work together in a very real way, right? Like people who advocate for captions don't also advocate for audio description and vice versa. I think that is very slowly starting to change, but the change is very slow. And I would like to see it happen more. That was a long-winded answer, and I apologize. What's your biggest frustration?
No, it was great. I think my biggest frustration is in a similar vein is systems that oppress people with disabilities. One thing that I'm like currently a little frustrated about is diversity, equity, inclusion that doesn't include disability. And disability is such a cross-sectional identity that happens to every community and yet is, I feel like, very underrepresented. And there are so many ableist thoughts out there. Ableism is the thought that able-bodied people are somehow better than disabled body people. And that was a terrible description of what that is, but I just wanted to make sure that if I'm using words that people don't know, that they have a little context into it. But I find myself as a neurodiverse person running into a lot of barriers that I don't see other people running into. And so, such as, it's been almost impossible for me to get a promotion at a job. And so it's very frustrating for me because I don't perform neurotypically, and a lot of systems are set up for, you know, neurotypical able-bodied people to be successful. And because I am neurodiverse, it's not like I can solve it through accessibility. This is like system-wide changes that need to happen to make sure that we are creating space to elevate people who maybe think differently, who maybe show up in the world differently, who have value. It's very hard for me, I think, in my career to feel like the way that I think or the way that I show up is of value. And so it's very, very frustrating for me individually.
I wonder if some of the problems with diversity, equity, and inclusion relate back to that pernicious idea of the pie, right? Of there being only so much to go around. I was sort of watching a very fascinating documentary about feminism in the 60s and how they specifically wanted to exclude women who were not, you know, straight, because they were like, oh, well, we don't want our movement to be about that because they're not going to win. So we need to exclude them to make sure that we can win, because there's only so much that can be done. Right. And I wonder if that story in some small way is playing out again when it comes to including disability into this.
I think that's an interesting thing, because I know some people who have the cross section between the queer identity and the disabled identity, and where they feel more included in the queer identity than they do in the disabled identity. And I think there's so many things. It's a multifaceted issue. But I do think that there are parts of disability that are so excluded from society in a way that makes it even harder for us all to connect with each other.
I mean, I think it's so interesting that you said that you know folks who feel more included in the queer community than the disability community. Because I know folks and have spoken to folks and have had stories told by folks who feel exactly the opposite.
Interesting.
And who have been told that, like, hey, we are already a small disenfranchised community. We cannot afford to make materials accessible to you. And we need to be exempted from, like, accessibility laws around physical spaces because we are such a small, underrepresented sort of disenfranchised community that putting accessibility requirements on us is too much of a burden. And so we shouldn't have to do it. And so you just have to be excluded because that's the way it is.
Fascinating. Yeah, no, I think that this is the reason that when you've met one disabled person, you've met one disabled person. When you've met one queer person, you've met one queer person. You know, like, we can't generalize about people. And that's why having conversations with people really opens up our world. It really opens us up to see, like, the value of all of our different perspectives to make a more inclusive world that allows us all to be successful. Sam, what is a myth around disability that you want to bust?
The myth that I bring up in a lot of the talks that I give in the presentations, and it relates directly to, you know, what I call this pernicious idea of the pie. And that is the idea that accessibility is somehow a burden or a charity, or it takes away, or it means that designers have to, you know, aim for the lowest common denominator, things like that. More accessible things are better things, right? They're more customizable for everyone. They are more useful in more different types of situations. Diverse teams create better results. And so accessibility is a tide that lifts all boats. It's not like, oh, if we have to do this accessibility thing, it's taking away and now there's going to be less resources and less thing. Doing this includes more people. It has return on investment, and doing more of it includes more people and it has greater returns. It doesn't take away, and it's not a what they call a zero win game, right? Where like, if you get your thing, I don't get my thing. That's just not how it works, either from a disability sort of thing, or we hear this right in companies, like, I don't have the time to do this. I don't have the resources to do accessibility. I can't do it because X, Y, and Z. And that's just not correct. Accessible things are better things. An accessible world is a better world. And accessibility is not a moral calling or a kind of charitable calling. Accessibility is something that makes things objectively better.
Oh, I'm over here like snapping in my head. I fully agree. Oh, well, we're getting close to the end. Oh, yeah, I have to do a myth. I think that the myth, and I've talked about this earlier, is basically that when you've met somebody who has a specific identity within disability, that you know something about the community. And I think that so often I see that people without disabilities are making a lot of the decisions for accessibility, making a lot of these decisions, and they don't have that lived experience. I guess the myth I want to bust is that people are the same, you know, and that disability is a spectrum, or how we like to say it, the disability bandwidth, which, well, the reason we call this disability bandwidth is that, you know, we didn't want to use the word spectrum because we didn't want to be that specific, but bandwidth sort of has that same connotation of being about a range of stuff. And so I guess the myth, I'm not really being very clear right now. So Sam, can you help me out?
The myth seems to be that people with disabilities are a monolith, right? I think we have had guests on the show already who would not necessarily agree with each other. I think if we looked hard enough, you and I could find things that we don't necessarily agree on. There are certainly other blind people who think things that I do not agree with. And that is healthy and fine and okay. And that is necessary to keep in mind, right? You wouldn't assume, I mean, if you say, oh, all people of this ethnicity are like this, we know that's not okay, but somehow it's okay to say, oh, blind people need this, right? It's somehow okay in the disability space, and it's not. And in some real ways, I think, people with disabilities, if you are a person with a disability, stop for a minute and think about maybe some of the ways that you have bought into this myth, right? Sometimes there's this feeling of like, oh, I don't want this other person with a disability, like if they do something that represents poorly on me, right? And sometimes we can look down on each other, or we can compare ourselves in that way, because we all buy into this myth. And so it's a myth that needs to be busted sort of worldwide for everyone.
Yeah, I think Sherry talks about this in our first episode, which everybody will listen to after this one. It will come out next week. So this podcast will be a weekly podcast, and we can't wait for you all to hear it. And so I'm going to take us out on the question that we ask most of our guests. I think we missed a few, but what is the first piece of technology you remember using, and what was it for?
I have used so much technology over the years. And I also want to do the very unhelpful thing where I want you to define using, because as I said, my father worked at IBM for many, many years. And so like when I was like three, he'd put, you know, his computer had OS2 on it, and he'd set it up so that like I could press the buttons on the keyboard and it wouldn't do any harm, but it would sort of, you know, talk to me and I could, you know, pretend I'm using the computer. But like, I was three. Does that count as the first piece of technology I used? I don't think so.
What do you remember? What is the first piece of technology? Or maybe I can rephrase this.
I remember
this.
I absolutely remember that. But I don't think I was using it for anything. You know what I mean? I was just pressing the keys and it was making funny noises, which was great when you were three. But I think the first sort of piece of technology I ever used for a thing, was probably either the Speak and Spell, which many of you probably remember, like E.T. movies.
That's the first thing I remember.
And the sort of that voice, now spell, sugar. That is correct. Like it's that thing. They actually released a version of that, which I had with all of the letters in Braille on the, on the keyboard. And so it was a way to spell, and it was a way to sort of, learn Braille and become more familiar with the Braille letters by pressing the thing and hearing it say the thing. And then shortly thereafter, I had an Apple II computer that I got used from the school board. So I'm not old enough to use like a new Apple II, but I had a used Apple II, and I remember playing all those old text adventures and all that fun stuff. What about you? Speak and Spell seems close
speak
to your heart
and spell.
As well.
Yeah, Speak and Spell. I remember doing Speak and Spell. I also had, my dad was really into computers, still very into computers. And we had this computer that was just green and black. Like the computer monitor was green and black. And I don't know what the computer was that we were using, but I remember playing games on it. But I think the first like real technology that I remember actively playing games on was a Jaguar. It was the Jaguar?
The first 64-bit console, and they had those ridiculous commercials.
Oh, they had commercials? I don't remember the commercials, but I remember playing Doom, like as a child playing Doom. And just it being really bloody and graphic, but also, very bitty. So it wasn't like that graphic. But I remember playing Doom as a child on a Jaguar.
Hey, and based on both of our total non-ability at spelling, the Speak and Spell was obviously very effective.
Yeah, I don't remember enjoying the Speak and Spell, but I remember enjoying the Jaguar. I remember also I loved recording things off of the television so I could memorize them. I didn't really learn how to read till I was in 11th grade, and so I was a memorizer. And so how I would do that is I had just like a play school sort of recording system that had a microphone on it, and I would tape the microphone and I would record TV shows.
So can you quote shows you memorized back in the day? Give us a quote.
No, but I did memorize Ace Ventura, and I annoyed everybody because I would say all the words. So
I did that with Monty Python when I was a bit older. I don't know what it is about Monty Python fans with having to memorize it and quote it at a drop of a hat, but there seems to be a phase that every humor lover has to go through.
I would memorize, I would record a lot of comedy specials so that I could get better at timing and stuff like that. A lot of the things that I did with technology was to learn how to show up as neurotypical, learn how to get timing, learn how to talk to people. I actually recently was talking with someone yesterday about this and realized how many things that I have done in my life to be perceived as a neurotypical person. It's fascinating. Like, I've been studying humans as if it's a totally different thing so that I could show up and I'm hoping as I'm starting to uncover and unpack these things that I will be able to show up more authentically who I am and less masked of a person.
Because George Carlin is like the perfect example of somebody who is obviously neurotypical. No, I don't know. It just seems like a very interesting, the way that people are, it's become more so, right? We've become more and more manufactured, right? On TV or radio or in media, do you see real people being real? I wonder if that's like a problem for this generation as they sort of come up.
I mean, it was a problem for me growing up, who was a latchkey kid, which means that I was a popped in front of the television 80s child who just really I learned a lot from television, for better, for worse, mostly for worse, learned a lot of poor behaviors through television. That's why I think it's really important to have representation in media and have people who have actual lived experiences making the media, because we do learn a lot from it. Went completely off into left field there, but let me bring it back because we're at the end of the episode. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you want to talk about, Sam?
I mean, I could just have a conversation with you forever, but I think we covered it all. And I can't wait for everyone to get to hear the first episode next week. So remember I was going to say like and subscribe, but I think that's only on YouTube. But absolutely make sure you're following the podcast, because it's going to be really great, if I do say so myself.
So exciting. And you can find us at disabilitybandwidth.com and on Twitter at disabilitybandwidth and on Instagram at disabilitybandwidth. And I'm sure we'll get onto other social medias. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. And this is really exciting. You're going to love it. It's great. Mm. And yeah, I don't know where to go. Sam. Whoops.
I mean, knocking over the microphone is a great, isn't that called a mic drop?
And that's how we're ending this. Mic drop. All right.
Thanks for listening to Disability Bandwidth. If you like this episode of Disability Bandwidth, please subscribe and share it with friends and family. Today's episode was hosted by Sam Prue and Nikki Nolan. Edited and produced by Nikki Nolan. Transcripts are written by Emma Klauber. Theme music is created by F.A. Achman. Special thanks to everyone at Fable who, without their support, this show would not be possible. You can find out more about Disability Bandwidth on Twitter and Instagram at Disability Bandwidth or on our website at disabilitybandwidth.com.